our serenade. We fell in love when we heard it played over and over and over and over again.
We present Music of a Small Life by Ted Albury, with James Bolan as J.A. Foster.
I'd steal a kiss and repeat each line over and over and over and over and then.
Come together in remembrance of a quiet, unobtrusive man, James Arnold Foster, Jimmy Foster. Few, if any, of us can claim to have known him well. He was not a man who sought popularity, preferring the peace and quiet of the background of life. As a child, he attended our Sunday school regularly, and as a young man, he was a member of the church tennis club. When I first came to this parish, he was rendering valuable service as a scouter to our senior scouts. There is little more to say of this modest man who lived among us for so many years. A man who seemed to ask so little of life. Let us sing together hymn number 317. The day thou gavest, Lord, is ended.
I liked Sunday school. They were nice people. They gave us text cards. It was a wooden building. It always smelled of pencils. I suppose it was the cedar wood. There was a picture on the wall of Jesus with a group of children. And underneath it said, "Suffer little children to come unto me." I liked that. I still do. On Saturday afternoons, I used to go with Grandma to Witten Cemetery to tidy up Auntie Louie's grave and any others that were looking neglected. On Sunday evening, Grandma went to the central hall. If I had to go with her, she gave me some cashews to suck to keep me quiet. Every morning after Grandpa had gone to work, she put on the same two gramophone records as a signal for me to get up. The first one was to wake me up. By the time the second record went on, it meant I ought to be dressed and washing. I can remember being home on leave. Grandpa had died in the first year of the war. Somehow we got to talking about those two gramophone records, and I said that she or Grandpa must have known something about music to have chosen the music from Carmen. She got into one of those fits of laughter that only rather stout ladies seem to have. When I was small and in bed, night, I could hear her down in the kitchen. And it was hard sometimes to tell whether she was laughing or crying. It used to worry me terribly. And I'd go to the banisters at the top of the stairs so that I could hear better. I got my head stuck between the banisters one night. They'd have to fetch Uncle Arthur and his saw to cut me free. Anyway, Grandma told me that the records hadn't been chosen by them. The gramophone and the two records were in payment of a bad debt that somebody had owed Grandpa. Some people keep photographs to remind them about past times. Others keep diaries. I'd never done either of these things. Well, they're fine if you're part of a family. You can show others the pictures or tell them about the notes in your diary. But I live alone. I don't have a family. And for me, it's always been music that brought back old times. And if that sounds a bit posh, perhaps I'd better explain. I don't know anything about music. I wouldn't even say I'm a music lover. But when I hear some songs, it takes me back down the years and reminds me of things that I'd thought were long forgotten. They're often not very important things, but it's like being there again. A lot of people think that those songs of the 30s and 40s were a lot of rubbish. Too sugary, too sentimental. Well, that's as may be. But at least they were good melodies and real words, and you could hear the words. As for being sentimental, maybe people were nicer in those days. We didn't expect much from life, but we expected a lot from one another. Young kids who grow up on today's pop rubbish won't ever be able to say, listen, they're playing our tune. The pop stuff is here and gone in a matter of weeks, and there's not much that's going to survive. There was music I got to like that wasn't really nostalgia. In a way, it was because it reminded me of Maria. But that's getting too far ahead. When I started work at the foundry, there was the BBC dance band every night. 10 o'clock, I think it was. Jack Payne and his band. We all liked his band. Apart from anything else, he was one of us, a Birmingham lad. His father was a dentist in town. There was one song I always remember.
How I'd love to hear the organ in the chapel in the moonlight while we're strolling down the aisle. How I'd love to hear you whisper in the chapel in the moonlight, that the love light in your eyes forever will shine.
I can remember during the war when we went into Madagascar, the Germans had an office there, some sort of control commission. And in their mess, there was a pile of gramophone records. And there it was, in French. La Chapelle au Clair de Lune. Real romantic stuff it was.
La Chapelle au Clair de Lune, où j'ai tant rêvé de vous, attendant leur opportune de nos rendez-vous. Amours en close, et je reviens tendrement près d'elle parmi les roses, inlassablement.
After work, I go to a local tennis club. It belonged to the Congregational Church. I suppose there were about 20 of us. One or two of us used to club together to buy records. Believe it or not, you could buy a record in those days for sixpence. But the records from the big companies were one and sixpence. And they had the big bands. Harry Roy, Bert Ambrose, Roy Fox and Lou Stone. A lad named Charlie and me went potty and invested in two records between us. It got to be a bit of a strain being joint owner of two records. I didn't have a gramophone myself, so Charlie kept them at his place. In the end, we decided, in the interests of peace and quiet, that we'd better have one each. And I chose the Harry Roy one.
Somebody told my gal, somebody told my pal, somebody came and took her away. She didn't even say that she was leaving. Oh, the kisses I loved so. The kisses, now I know. Oh, gee, I know that she, if she saw me brokenhearted, I am just a lonesome pal. Somebody stole my gal.
But oddly enough, the one I remember best was Charlie's choice. I've heard it on odd occasions down the years, just two or three times. It was a cheerful, jolly sort of record. My Little Grass Shack in Kealakekua, Hawaii. Just after Alamein, we camped one night near Tobruk. We fried up some bangers, and after we'd eaten, I went off to... Well, let's leave it at that. I walked about 10 yards away, and there were some graves there. They turned out to be the graves of an RAF air crew. And there, on one of the wooden crosses, it said, Flight Sergeant C.H. Langley. And that was Charlie. His mother gave me the record, and a couple of others after I got back. I played it once, but it wasn't the same. Wasn't jolly anymore. It was sad.
Dort wollen wir uns wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen, wie einst Lili Marleen.
Yeah, there was always Lili Marleen on the German program for troops in North Africa. It's become part of those days, I suppose, but... it never really caught on with me. In the first months of the war, before we joined up, Charlie George and I used to go to the Palais in Erdington on Saturday nights. We used to meet three girls there. There was one of them. She was called Hazel. Or was it Helen? Anyway, I rather fancied her. We never came to anything, though. But there was a song we used to dance to that always makes me remember her.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Oh, but you're lovely with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft. There is nothing for me but to love you just the way you look tonight.
It still reminds me of her, even though I can't remember her name. She lived somewhere up by the Dunlop on the 79 tram route. When the unit went on to Italy, there was all the music you could want. I had a girlfriend in Naples. She was very pretty. We had a song. We called it our signature tune.
Parlami d'amore, ma mio, tutta la mia vita sei tu. Gli occhi tuoi belli brillano.
She wanted to marry me, but she was much better educated than I was. She was 18 and I was 24 or 25. I thought a lot of her. And all that's not really true. I was head over heels in love with her. I'd met her at the Forces Club in Naples. She'd been serving tea and had laughed and said I must be kidding when I asked for 3 spoons of sugar. She'd let me walk her home and I'd arranged to see her the next day. She lived in a villa up on the hill. Her father was a lawyer. I think he worked for the fascists. But he spoke good English and he was working for the military government then. Although she was so beautiful, she never seemed to cash in on it. I suppose she must have noticed all the men staring at her. But she didn't take any notice of them when she was with me. I saw her every day. We'd walk up to the woods behind where she lived and just sit there and talk. I don't remember how we got on to us being married, but we did. I didn't kid her at all. I told her about my job and the poor pay and all that. She'd just smile and put her arm round my shoulder. Except for Grandma, she was the first person in my life who seemed to like me just as I was. She always made me feel I was special. The army was against soldiers marrying Italian girls, but they couldn't actually stop you, so it was arranged that I should see her father at his office. I told him he wanted to get married. It was like getting into a cold bath. He said we were living in a fool's paradise. There were the problems of religion and nationality that I couldn't support her. We'd be living in poverty, and if I really cared for her, I wouldn't want that. And finally, he said I was taking advantage of a young girl who was too loving and too innocent to realize what the consequences would be. Taking advantage of a wartime situation and the glamour of a uniform. And in my heart of hearts, I thought he was right. Not completely right, but right enough not to be ignored. I felt like I'd been beaten up. I never saw her again. That was how he wanted it. I often think of her and wish... Ah, that's it. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. If I'd have my wish, I'd be married to my Maria. And one way or another, my life would have been very different. Anyway, after Italy, I ended up with 30 Corps in Germany. God, what a shambles that was. They made a mess of Coventry and Birmingham, but believe me, you wouldn't have wished what they got on your worst enemy. I suppose they were our worst enemy. But it was terrible. I'd seen dead people and bombed buildings before, but never anything like that. I was stationed at a place called Hildesheim, just south of Hanover. It was one of those oldie-worldy towns like Stratford-on-Avon, and according to the survivors, it had been wiped out in one raid. Only took an hour. God knows why they did it. There were no troops or factories there. I suppose there must have been a reason, or they wouldn't have done it. In the early days, we weren't allowed to fraternize, as they called it, with the Germans. Not having anything to do with them was supposed to make them feel ashamed of themselves. And I think they were too occupied with digging out the dead bodies and trying to get a crust of bread to care what we were doing. It was pretty boring for the last 6 months before I was demobbed. But I had a girlfriend. She wasn't as pretty as Maria. Well, I suppose that's not really fair. She was pretty in a different sort of way. Blonde and blue-eyed with her hair done in braids. I'd always liked girls with braided hair. They reminded me of a picture I once saw in the art gallery. Pre-Raphaelite, they said it was. Whatever that mean. Her name was Ursula. Uschi for short in German. And I used to take her food and chocolate. And she washed my kit for me. I suppose she sold the chocolate on the black market. Not that I minded. Her favourite song was called Sag Beim Abscheid. She sang it to me sometimes. She got a nice voice, and she found me a record of it and gave it to me to take home when I was demobbed. It's about not ever saying goodbye.
Sag Beim Abscheid, leise Servus, nicht leb wohl und nicht adieu, diese Worte tun. Das kleine Wörtchen Servus ist ein lieber letzter Gruß, wenn man Abschied nehmen muss.
I wouldn't say I liked being in the army, but I missed it, and the mates I'd made when I came out. I didn't expect to be treated like a hero or anything like that, but I thought that people would have appreciated what we did and helped us a bit. They didn't give a damn. Just went on about what a terrible time they'd had in the air raids, while we were swanning round the world and having a good time. I found it hard to settle down. The fellas I knew were dead or married or had moved away. Some of those who'd stayed behind had gone up in the world and they didn't want to know you. Grandma had died in the last days of the war, so I had no relatives. I rented a room in Erdington. Nothing special, but it was clean, and the landlady was particular about who she took in. I'd got 4 weeks to mob leave and my gratuity, and I looked round for some work. I thought I might find something more interesting, but I hadn't got a trade or any useful experience. My army references said I was of good character and had an honourable discharge. I suppose they thought this was a bit tame, so my CO had put a PS in his own hand, saying I held the company record for stripping down a Bren gun blindfolded. The chap at the labour exchange had given me a pretty odd look when he read that. I went for 2 or 3 interviews. One as a salesman in a shoe shop, one as an assistant in the local library, and the last was as a long-distance lorry driver. I didn't get any of them. Either I hadn't got the schooling qualifications or the experience. To tell the truth, I didn't belong here anymore. In fact, I didn't belong anywhere. I knew where I'd like to be, but that wasn't on. I used to go to places like Sutton Park or the Lickies, places I'd been to when I was a kid, Sunday school treats, and I'd pretend she was with me. I used to talk to her, out loud. But it didn't work. She wasn't with me, and that was that. I went back to the same old job. They made me a progress chaser in the foundry. Looking back, I think it was pretty boring, but you expected work to be boring in those days. Charlie was dead and George was married. I used to have a meal with George and his wife every now and again. Jean was always trying to find some girl for me to marry, but I wasn't interested. I never told him about Maria or anybody else. I wasn't sure they'd understand. In fact, I wasn't sure they'd even believe me that a girl as beautiful as Maria could be interested in the likes of me. I went to dances now and again on my own, but it wasn't much fun. It was all jive now. When I was in the army, we used to boogie-woogie in our great big army boots to Glenn Miller.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a chance.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga juju?
I got my fare.
And just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania Station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner is not honor, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Come on, all I'm rolling, gotta keep it rolling.
Ooh, ooh, Chattanooga, there you are.
You can imagine what it was like in those village halls on a Saturday night. People said I ought to go out more, meet people, join a club. You know the sort of thing they say. You'd probably laugh, but I joined the Scouts. I'd never been a Scout, but I became a Scouter and helped with one of the local troops. They were nice lads, and I learned how to tie knots and that sort of thing so that I could teach them. One lesson ahead of my pupils. We went on weekend camps to Malvern and Stratford. We went on hikes and boys got badges and small promotions. I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, but I felt I was helping and was part of a friendly community. They say listeners never hear any good of themselves. And I certainly didn't that day. I was in the works toilet. There were two men from the machine shop came in. They probably didn't realize that one of the cubicles was occupied. They were talking about me because I'd been selling tickets around the works for a scout raffle. It could be they only said it as a joke. Perhaps I was just looking for an excuse. One of them said that maybe my interest in the scouts had an ulterior motive. The one that always gets in the newspapers. I won't go into details like he did. But I remember actually blushing as I sat there. And feeling very cold. Inside and out. I was trembling when I left the place. And I wrote a note to the group scoutmaster that night. Resigning. I didn't give a reason. I didn't see why I should. And there was no cause to tell a lie. It was about that time that I heard a song. I think it came out during the war.
And when we meet
we don't see. Through the soul, for words are weak when love is strong, and when we kiss, there's a sound like violin. Our song becomes a thrilling concerto for two, for me and you.
A fellow in the drawing office heard me whistling it when I was clocking out one evening. Asked me if I liked Tchaikovsky. I told him I'd never heard of him. Looking back, he must have thought I was joking. Either that or I was a complete idiot. We were going the same way home, and we walked back to Gravelly Hill together, and he told me that the song was a crib from a piano concerto by this chap Tchaikovsky, a Russian. The fellow from the drawing office's name was Victor. I called him Vic once or twice, and he told me he preferred the name in full. That makes him sound a bit of a snob, but he wasn't. He just preferred to be called Victor. And he was more a Victor than a Vic. He contacted me the next day, said there was a concert on at the town hall on Saturday night and they were playing this concerto. Would I like to go with him? I said yes, but I didn't mean it. Was fantastic. I tell you, it was like lying in a warm bath eating Turkish delight on a Friday night with bank holiday coming up on the Monday. It wasn't until I was in bed that night that I realized why I liked it so much. It was like Tchaikovsky knew about me, as though he understood. All that love pouring out in the music and the sadness, knowing it was all wasted. It was how I'd felt about Maria. It was how I still felt about her. But like with him, there was nobody to say it to. I used to get very down at times in those days, and despite the discovery of this different sort of music, I used to play an old 78 that I'd bought at a church bazaar. The words seemed to say what I was feeling.
Tonight, I mustn't think of her. Music, maestro, please. Tonight, I must forget how much I need her. So, Mr. Leader, play your lilting melodies. Ragtime, jazz, time, swing, any old thing to help me ease the pain that solitude can bring. She used to like waltzes, so please don't play a waltz.
I bought a proper gramophone and a record of the concerto. It was one of the first LPs. Sounds a bit daft to buy a gramophone and only have one record. But it wasn't just a gramophone record to me. It was me with Maria. I thought about her every day. Not about what she might be doing or who she'd married, not even if she was happy. She was just with me, like she was those years before. I'd never made love to her. She was too special for that sort of thing. When the battalion moved up to Rome, we stopped for a break just outside a small village. There was one of those roadside shrines with a Madonna who looked just like my Maria. I was tempted to take it. But I picked some wild flowers instead and put them at the foot of the shrine. And my friend Victor had opened the other music doors for me. Rachmaninoff. Mendelssohn. Max Bruch. It was almost a year later when Victor invited me to his room. He lived only about 10 minutes' walk away from me, but we kept ourselves to ourselves. He played me some chamber music, a trio, and I knew then that I'd never liked chamber music. It was Beethoven, and it went on and on and on. Every time they stopped, I breathed a sigh of relief, and then they'd start up again. Victor explained it all. The themes, the shaping, the key changes, all that technical stuff. I told him quite honestly that it was beyond me. I'd never like it. It was too thin, too cold-blooded. He just smiled and said, I'd learn someday. And believe it or not, he was right. It was at least a year later, and he'd brought some records over to my place on a Saturday night. And my landlady liked old Victor. She thought he was a cut above the rest of us normal working fellas. I think she only put up with me because my hair was going grey, so I was safe and respectable. She went down to the pictures on Saturday nights anyway. No matter what was on, she went. Cowboys, musicals, thrillers, they were all the same to her. Victor and I used to put on small concerts for one another, 4 or 5 records each. He always chose one piece of chamber music. I'd make polite noises and he'd laugh because he knew I didn't really like it. Anyway, that night he put on a record. Well, I was bowled over. It was chamber music, all right. A Schubert trio. But what music? I was so pleased with myself for liking it that you'd have thought I'd just climbed Everest. And Victor just sat there grinning, saying there was plenty more where that came from. He was right, of course. I gradually got to like other bits of chamber music, but none moved me like the Schubert. The trouble was that Victor could understand the music. He could read scores and criticize performances, but I could only like it or not like it. Like the joke they always make about people who don't understand art but know what they like. Anyway, that Schubert piece was another for me and Maria. I had no doubt about that. And for me, as the years rolled by, I judged everything, people and music, by whether Maria would have liked them or not. They say that ignorance is bliss, but it isn't always. We'd been to a couple of operas, Victor and me, and I found them boring too. Women singers in their 50s pretending to be teenagers, and you could never make out the words, even if they were singing in English. Victor told me to close my eyes and just listen to the singing in the orchestra. But I didn't see any sense in paying a quid for a ticket plus the bus fare and then not looking. But he played a trick on me one night and told me to close my eyes while he played me a record. I liked that so much he gave me the record. And although I felt guilty, I took it. I played it every day. And then one evening when we were walking home, he told me the story of Madame Butterfly and the American who'd put the Japanese girl in the family way and just left her. Went off and married the American girl he was engaged to. I was so angry about that man. How could he do it? I was getting undressed that night when it suddenly struck me. Maybe I was no better than that man. I'd gone off and never explained to Maria. There were no babies involved, but I'm not sure that that excuses what I did.
Parlami d'amore,
I thought about it a lot. Why should I have taken any notes of what her father said? Okay, he was a lawyer, cleverer than I was. But surely it was up to me and Maria. I'd never pretended to be anything I wasn't. She knew I was a working chap. He'd said it was just the uniform that impressed her. But no girl I've ever met was impressed by a battle dress. Maybe I should have stood up to him. Maybe we should have been okay, even if we were poor. And maybe the least I should have done was talk it over with Maria. For a long time, I didn't play my records. Any of them. People like me live very ordinary lives. Nothing much happens. We do as we're told and get on with our lives and our jobs. Even being in the army in the war didn't mean much to me. I wasn't in any action. I stayed a private all the time I was in, and that was it. That's how people like me live. There's nothing wrong with that. I did think once or twice of going back to Italy to see if I could find out what had happened to her. But something always stopped me. After all those years, she'd bound to have forgotten me. She'd probably be married. She could even have teenage children. And I'd be just an embarrassment. I gradually went back to playing my records again, but I never really felt the same. Not only about the music, but about myself. I always seemed worried, but I didn't know what I was worried about. But looking back on it now, I think in my heart of hearts, I did know. When I came into hospital the first time, they said it was a stroke. And they said I'd have to take it easy. And I did. But now it's happened the second time, I know it's much worse. After a few weeks, they gave me a private room. They even let me have my gramophone and a few records. I never played them. It was too much of an effort. Victor came to see me once, but I could see it upset him. All the tubes and things and me not being able to talk much. He'd brought me a record and he left it on the little table. He said it was a piece by a French chap called Massenet. He said it was my kind of music. That was 3 weeks ago. The night nurse has just come in. She's Irish, dark hair and rather jolly. She's clearing the little table and she's picked up Victor's record, reading the sleeve and turning, pointing at it, asking me if I'd like to hear it. I nodded and she's going to put it on. That's my kind of music, all right. I've got a feeling that everything's going to be okay. And I will see Maria. I'm sure I will.
I
That was Music of a Small Life by Ted Albury. You heard James Bolam as James Arnold Foster and Nigel Graham as the parson. The play was directed by Christopher Venning.